We are in Mark chapter 6, if you'll turn there. Beginning in verse 45, it says, "And straightway he constrained his disciples to get into the ship, to go to the other side before unto Bethsaida, while he sent away the people. When he had sent them away, he departed into a mountain to pray. And when evening was come, the ship was in the midst of the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw them toiling in their rowing, for the wind was contrary unto them. And about the fourth watch, between 3 and 6 in the morning, about the fourth watch of the night, he cometh unto them, walking upon the sea, and would have passed them by." Lord, what does that mean? "And when they saw him walking upon the sea, they supposed it had been a spirit. They cried out. They all saw him and were troubled. And immediately he talked with them and said unto them, Be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid. And he went up unto them into the ship, and the wind ceased, and they were sore amazed in themselves beyond measure, and they wondered. For they considered not the miracle of the loaves, for their heart was hardened." They considered not the miracle of the loaves. What it's telling us is this scene is in context of the feeding of the 5,000. It doesn't stand alone. It is in context of the feeding of the 5,000 that he constrains the disciples to get into the boat and he sends the multitude away. John is the one who tells us that he perceived that the crowds would come and make him king at that point in time. Jesus knows the next day, within 24 hours, in John chapter 6, verse 66, it says, many of them will forsake him. In this scene, they want to make him king. He knows that a year from this time, they'll be crying, "Hosanna, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord," on Palm Sunday, and that within 5 days, they'll be crying, "Crucify him, crucify him." These crowds want to make him king, and it's an interesting picture of politics. They want to make him king. They want to make him bread king. They think Jesus is the bread king. You produce somebody who feeds us and keeps our belly full, that's the kind of king we're looking for. That's Grandpa Stroman. That's not Jesus Christ, the bread king. You know, isn't it interesting? They didn't want to make him king when he raised the dead, when he cleansed the lepers, when he opened the eyes of the blind, when he preached the truth. In none of those instances do they want to make him king. It's when he feeds them. The Antichrist will come to power in the same way, supposedly with the answers to people's physical, temporary needs. They want to make him king. Now, Jesus knows something. He knows that they are in more danger with the wrong perspective of who he is than they are in the middle of a storm. He knows that it is more dangerous for them to perceive him as being king on basis of providing bread than it is for them to be in a storm with him watching over. And there are many people in the church today that perceive the Lord as the bread king. And as long as everything's going good, as long as we're healthy, as long as we're prospering, Jesus is somebody who's great to serve. But he's a much greater king than that. He's the king of storms. He's the Lord of storms also. And you see people who only trust in God to a point until the report comes back from the doctor that there's cancer, or until they get fired, or until the family breaks up in some way, or until there's a death, or until there's a difficult circumstance, because they perceive that if Jesus is in their life, they should always have bread. Everything should be wonderful. And they forget that he's the Lord of storms also. He constrains them to get in the boat. He argues with them. They wanted to see him king then too, because they thought all he was going to do was overthrow Rome. He came to overthrow sin and death. He forces the crowds to go away, forces his disciples to head out towards Bethsaida, and he goes up into a mountain to pray. Now, we're treading on holy ground. I don't know what was in his heart. I wonder. John the Baptist had just been killed. The crowds will be turning away. It's the time of the Passover. Certainly, many of those things are washing over his heart as he prays with the Father. But he's praying. Mark alone tells us he's watching them. He sees them out in the middle of the sea. Now, John tells us how many furlongs they are. They're exactly dead center. They're between 3.25, 3.5 miles. The sea there is 7 miles wide. They're out in the middle of the sea. What had happened was, evidently, when Jesus sent them out at night, put up their sail, they headed for Bethsaida. Somewhere along the way, the winds become contrary. Sail does them no good. They take the sail down, they begin to row. It tells us here that it was about the fourth watch that Jesus came to them. He sent them out sometime around 6 in the evening or so. They have been rowing for 8 to 10 hours. The wind is contrary. They're in the middle of the sea, not making any progress. Try to imagine rowing 8 to 10 hours. You know that there are blisters bleeding on their hands. Their backs are aching, their muscles are sore. I'm sure for the next 4 or 5 days, their muscles reminded them every day of this scene. Now, they're in the middle of his will. You know, they could have turned the ship about and let themselves be driven with the wind and come back. We have to hand it to them. Jesus said, go that way. And he said, go ahead, which is the idea is I'll be coming. Didn't say how. And at least they kept the boat pointed in the right direction. Mark says they were tortured in their rowing. Now, Jesus, it tells us, is watching them, praying for them. Some scholars try to say, well, it must have been a clear night. It was near Passover. The moon was full because it's a lunar feast. Therefore, he could see them. Let me tell you something. To see somebody 3.5 miles away in a storm at night is supernatural. Well, I don't know why they try to give Jesus a sunny night, you know, moonlit night, when he's going to come down and walk across the water. He doesn't need help seeing them in the storm. He sees them the same way he sees us. The Bible tells us that he ever liveth and maketh intercession for the saints in Hebrews 7:25, that he's praying for us today in our storms. And he sees us, not with a natural eye. He may have seen them clearly with his head bowed and his eyes closed. And he comes walking to them. Now you have to imagine the scene. They're rowing. They've given up on the sail. They're facing backwards the direction that he's coming from. So these 12 guys are there. They're rowing. They're pulling. Their muscles are sore. You know, he told us to go. This is the way he told us to go. And you can imagine what they're, you know, they're, shut up. Yes, this is the way he told us to go. Lightning flash. One of them says, see something? Did you see something? Well, you're crazy, you know, and then another lightning flash. You imagine 2 or 3 other guys. I saw that. What was that? See, that looked freaky, didn't it? Did you see something out there on the water? And you know, he gets closer. We don't know how close he is before they all begin to scream. They said they thought he was a spirit. It's not Numa. It's not a ghost. It's phantom. They think that he's the Grim Reaper. There's some type of, you know, local story involved with this, or some kind of superstition involved. They think he's a phantom. They said, did you see a, you know, thing over his shoulder with a big sickle on it? I know he's coming to take us down. And they start to scream, it says. These are the A apostles, not the B apostles, you know. They're all in the boat going, and Jesus is coming to them. They're screaming. He says, calm down, it's me. Don't be afraid. Be of good cheer. Now, at that point, Matthew tells us, Peter says, Lord, if that is you, like I've had other people walk across the sea in the middle of a storm and tell me, you know, if that is you, who did he think it was? If that is you, bid me to come to you on the water. Now, just try to imagine what a remarkable thing he just said. Thomas probably said, I can't believe it. And they said, you know, this is Storm 102. We already had Storm 101. This is where he rebukes the wind and the sea. Don't you remember this lesson? It's not get out of the boat and walk on the water. Now, isn't it interesting that Mark doesn't tell us? Mark was tutored by Peter. And we look at that and we think, well, it's for one of two reasons. Either it was Peter's humility and said to Mark, you know, you don't need to tell everybody I get out of the boat and walk on the water. Or it was Peter's embarrassment and said, you don't have to tell everybody that I start to sink when I get out on the water. It's not included. It's included in Matthew. If that's you, bid me to come to you in the water. And through the storm and through the wind, the voice simply comes, come. And it says Peter climbs over the side of the boat. It's a decent-sized boat, evidently. Now, what happens? Does he go, you know, does he test it? It says Jesus is walking upon. The Greek word is a p, and in the genitive, the way it's used here in the grammar, it means on the surface of. Jesus is literally walking on the surface of the water. He's not floating above it. He's not flying. He is walking on the water. And I don't imagine he's going up and down with waves. I imagine he's walking nice and calm right through a pathway, right through the midst of it. Peter gets out of the boat and begins to walk to Christ on the water. Now, you know the lesson, keeping your eyes on Jesus in the storms. It says, Peter began to behold the wind boisterous, and as he did, he began to sink. And he cried out. Now, what do you do if you're an employer and you've been trying to get your employees to shape up a little? And you tell them, okay, you can come out, walk on the water where I walk. And they start to sink. You say to them, well, you know, there's a few things you need to learn right now. I want you to remember this lesson. You need to be cognizant of the fact that you're not in charge here and you can't walk where I walk. Jesus doesn't do any of that. It says he just immediately, it says, takes hold of him, pulls him up, and they step into the boat together. John, in chapter 6, verse 15, verse 21, excuse me, very important, tells us this, that as soon as they stepped into the boat reached land. The boat, at the speed of light or the speed of thought, however we want to think about it, as soon as the feet of Jesus come into the boat, the bow of the boat crunches up onto the shore, 3.5 miles away, at the speed of light in an instant. And Matthew 14:33 says they look at Jesus when he got in the boat and they crunched up on the shore and they fell down around him and they said, truly, you are the Son of God, and they worshiped him. So we have this interesting scene here as we look at this lesson. What are his purposes as I look at this in my life? Because first of all, I get a little nervous when I think, Lord, you've preserved some record of a storm and handed it to me. It's a blessing that you're thinking of me, but I want to take a correspondence course here. I don't want to, you know, I just want to watch Peter and the guys and learn it from them, Lord. But as I look at it, the thing that unnerves me a little, and I'm a coward, you're looking at me like you're different, is that somehow we think that if Jesus constrains us and we obey, that brings us to some successful goal, some successful end. Okay, Lord, I'm doing your way. I've looked in your word. I'm obeying. I'm bringing my life into line. Now get me there. We mistake our personal dreams for God's purposes. We think, okay, I bring everything where you want it to be. Now, that's still the bread king, you see. I bring everything where you say it should be, and I'll obey you, and I'll bring my life in the line, and then you'll give me the raise, then you'll give me the wife, then you'll give me the husband, you'll get rid of the husband, whatever, you know. You know, we have this, Lord, I'll just, you know. And it's with our eye to a goal, quite often. And it's almost bargaining with them. All right, Lord, I'll obey. I'll do this and I'll do that and I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow the house down and then you get me to the goal. But as we look at the scene, the thing that unnerves me a little, and I believe it, is that God's goal differs from ours. God's goal is the process. Our goal is getting out of the process. Our goal is getting to the other shore, getting out of the storm. His goal is the process. Because I don't learn anything once I get to shore. I learn everything screaming in the middle of the storm. I learn everything rowing there and with my hands bleeding and my legs sore saying, this is what I get. You know, you said to come out here. I came out here. Now it's dark. You're not around everywhere. You know, this is supposed to be where you're in the boat and we wake you up and you rebuke the wind and the sea. And now you send us out here alone and accusing him because I can't see him and I'm not cognizant of him and I'm in a difficult situation that he's not there. He doesn't care. Where the scripture clearly reveals him on the mountain, observing them, praying, watching, caring. And that what he wants us to do is to see him walking above the storm. He wants us to trust in him and in his power. He doesn't just want us to get to the other shore. That's obvious because when he steps in the boat, they're there instantly. He could do that in an instant. That's not any trouble for him. There's something that he wants us to experience in the storm of his person. I don't want to do that. I'm an escapist. I want to, I don't believe in the Jesus that's going to give me a Mercedes-Benz or a Rolls-Royce and a mansion. We see those guys on TV. But I do believe in a middle-class Jesus. You're laughing. You know, there are Christians all around the world today suffering and starving, being crucified in the Sudan, war-torn areas, not enough food for the day, who have to believe that Jesus walks above those things. Jesus, who can multiply bread, is still there, watching them, caring for them. I'm not good at that. He's waiting for our process. Why does he wait so long? Why did he wait for 9 hours, 8 hours? Why did he wait so long? Well, I think he waits for the process to turn into a classroom. He waits for us. These were seamen. They were sailors. He waits for them to trim their sails. Okay, we know what to do now. We have a process. Wind's coming up contrary. Sails are fluttering, not doing anything. If we take the sails down, we know what to do. We've been here 1,000 times. We're all rowing. It's not until 9 hours later, when they're out right dead center out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee and have made no progress, that they're finally saying, what is this all about? You know, let's turn around. Let's get out of here. We could be back to shore in a half an hour if we let the wind drive us. And, oh, no, we can't do that. He told us to go this way. It's when they're to that point where they're exasperated, where now the process is turning into a classroom. Now the blackboard is set up. Now the lessons that he wants them to learn and us can be there. They're tormented, it says, directly in the path of obedience. Everything seems contrary. The wind, it says, is contrary. They have to learn that that is not a reflection of him. You see, Judas will commit suicide. We'll push him aside. But out of the other 11, every one of them will be martyred, but John. Matthew will be skinned alive in Iran. Andrew, crucified upside down, shot full of arrows. Peter, crucified upside down. You go through the list. Philip impaled on a pole. They need to know that he's the Lord of storms and not just the Lord of bread. They need to know that without evidence, when the wind is contrary, that he's seeing, superintending, loving, that he's committed, that the physical circumstances are not a reflection of him because he never changes. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Tough lesson when things are falling apart. One of your kids is dying in front of you. To stand back and say, Lord, you're the Lord of storms, too. I need to see you now walking above this. Lord Jesus, I need to see you above the storms of life. I need to see that you walk on top of all of this, Lord. That your will and your power, your sovereignty, Lord, is above and superintending all of these painful experiences in my life. Peter, certainly there's a lesson in Peter as we look at him, that sinking time is praying time. Now, nobody has to tell me that. You know, people say, you know, here comes Jesus. Mark's the one who says that he would have passed them by. Now, what does that mean? Is he in the passing lane? You know, here they are rowing in the storm. Is Jesus kind of walking, you know, 50 foot, you know, to the starboard or port going like he's just going to walk by? And they're going, yo. What does it mean he would have passed by? Well, you know, I don't think that's what it means. Twice in the book of Acts and twice in the Septuagint in the Old Testament, it uses the exact same word, and it means to come near to. And I think he had come out there to reveal something of himself, not to walk by them and leave them in the storm. He would have passed them by. You know, some scholars say, well, Jesus won't get involved in your circumstance unless he's invited. He's wandering out there on the surface of the water. He wants to be invited. Now, I don't know about you, but in my relationship with Jesus, he has a standing invitation. I've said, Lord, anytime you see me in a storm, don't wait for me to call out. Just immediately come and rebuke the wind and the sea. I just want you to know, we'll have this understanding for the rest of my life. You know, don't wait to be invited. Just please rescue me. I think that's foolishness. I think he came to them. I think that's where he was coming. I think he wanted to come by them, pass by them in the sense of approaching to them. Peter gets out of the boat, remarkably. Now look, I want to tell you this. I'm not a Peter critic. A lot of people criticize Peter in this scene. If he'd only had faith, if he kept his eyes on Jesus. I understand all those things. But my feet are dry. It's easy to criticize Peter with dry feet. Most Christians never get out of the boat to walk on the water. Myself, you know, I'm amazed because Peter says to him, if that's you, bid me to come to you. I would have been in the boat thinking, I hope you don't ask me to come out there. I don't want to walk out there. I believe you're the Lord. I believe you can walk. I don't need to do what you do. You're the shepherd. I'm just a sheep. So I'm not going to criticize Peter. Because all of the rest of the men in the boat saw something that they were supposed to carry for the rest of their lives too. That is that a human being who at God's bidding, not presumptuously, at God's bidding steps out of the boat onto the water where you have to walk in faith can be held up above those storms by his behest. Come, Peter, come to me. Problem is sinking time, praying time. And you notice Peter doesn't have time for a long prayer. He doesn't pontificate here. Short prayers are long enough when you're sinking in a storm. You know that. He simply says, Lord, save me. Direct, to the point, good opening, good closing. Lord, me. In the middle, save. And of course, if God bids us onto the water, we need to keep our eyes on him. We can't then begin to judge things in the natural. You know, I was watching this Discovery thing last night, and I like to do that with my kids. We, you know, the snakes are on my wife's. I can't watch this. You're making me turn that off. I can't watch this. No, you know. Honey, we like this. We're boys. We like to watch snakes swallow big things. But there was one part of it where there's a one of those chameleons, not one of the little ones they sell in the pet store, the animals, but this is the real ones, you know, with those funny feet, and they get about this big with one eye that goes one way and one eye that goes another way. Do you ever see those? Sometimes you wish you had those. You could look at one, you know, more than one thing at a time. You try when you're little, because you have at least one friend that can do that, that will keep one eye straight and make one eye go this way, make their eyes go apart. Beginners begin with make their eyes go cross-eyed, you know. And your mom says, they're going to lock like that. If you do that, they're going to stay like that. And then every time you see somebody with a crooked eye, you think, oh, they didn't listen to their mother. What happened is they... That's what Peter needed, because Peter couldn't keep his eyes on both at the same time. Couldn't keep his eyes on the Lord and on the storm. Couldn't focus on both. And I'm not a Peter critic. I don't want to get out of the boat. Isn't it interesting? When he's in the boat, he's toiling. He's sore. He's in pain. When he's out of the boat on the water with Jesus, he's sinking. I'm sure the other guys were saying, I'm glad I didn't do that. I thank God for Peter. Because what it means to me is there are times, and I know people here who have done it, their children with cancer, an unfaithful spouse, a financial disaster, who, like Peter, have walked above the storm and have kept their eyes on Jesus Christ. And that's much more important to him than reaching the other shore. That we trust him in the storms, that he isn't just the Lord of bread, but that he's the Lord of storms. It says this in Job, when Job's talking about God. If he contends with you, you cannot answer. He is wise in heart, mighty in strength. Who hath hardened himself against him and hath prospered? He removes the mountains, and they know not, which overturneth them in his anger, which shaketh the earth out of her place, and the pillars thereof tremble, which commandeth the sun that it rise not, and sealeth up the stars, which alone spreadeth out the heavens and treadeth upon the waves of the sea. Psalm 77 says this, Thy way, O Lord, is in the sea, and thy path in the great waters. Thy footsteps are not known. Isaiah obviously saying, Fear not, for I have redeemed thee. I have called thee by thy name, thou art mine. When thou passest through the waters, they shall not overflow thee. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned. Because I am the Lord, your God, the Holy One of Israel, thy Savior. Habakkuk tells us the same. Many places talk about him walking above the storm, walking on the mighty waters. I wonder what these men thought at the end of the day. Isn't it interesting when he steps into the boat, says immediately the bow crunches up on shore. Their destination was always Jesus in the boat, Jesus in the storm with them. It wasn't the shore. What they realize is what we really want in any situation is him with us in the storm. Then they were immediately at their destination. We'll pray for you today if you're in the midst of a storm. You know that in life, you're either in the middle of a storm, coming out of a storm, or going into a storm. So at one point, this will be information that is worth something to you. If you're sinking, thought you were doing pretty good in the storm, he'll lift you up. Remember a number of years ago when my younger son was dying in front of us, bleeding to death. We didn't think we were going to make the trauma unit. Blood was all over the inside of the car. My wife was screaming. I was doing 90 miles an hour going through red lights. And you get to the trauma unit, and you know, and they say, do you have medical coverage? You know, do you have? And I say, you're going to need medical coverage. If you don't, my kid's all blue and bloody. And but somehow in the process, all of a sudden thinking, well, this is it, Lord. But this is not goodbye. I'm going to see him again forever. and some peace, not for the natural mind, not for earthly deliberations, but something above that to say, this ain't going to be goodbye. This is what the gospel's all about. Heard Richard Wurmbrand say one time that tortured for 14 years in a Roman prison, they would do all kinds of things to them. And he said, one day they start taking them into another room and they would hear them asking them to deny Christ, and they would hear a gun going off. And he said, when they brought me in, he said there was blood on the floor. It was animal blood, he didn't know that. Put a gun to his head and said, we're going to count to 10. And if you don't renounce Christ, we're going to kill you. He said, by the time they got to 7, the gospel had become perfectly clear once again in my mind. I'm a sinner. I'm forgiven. I'm going to heaven. Bottom line. If you're here today and you're sinking, and people sink in all kinds of things, don't they? Storms take on all kinds of definitions. Peter's prayer was, Lord, save me. The thief on the cross that died next to Jesus Christ said, Lord, remember me today. That's all. Didn't know 4 spiritual laws. Didn't have a long, drawn-out prayer that somebody wrote out for them. A genuine heart cry to Jesus Christ. Lord, I'm drowning. Save me. I'm drowning in alcoholism. I'm drowning in sin. I'm drowning in drug abuse. Lord, I'm having suicidal thoughts. Lord, I'm sinking. I'm drowning. And if you're who your word says you are, Lord, then save me today. If that's you, and you've never met Christ, you only have religion, not relationship. I got 4 kids. I don't want a religion with them. I don't want them to see pictures of me and go to a father's club every Sunday morning and have somebody tell them, oh, he laid down his life for you. He loved you guys. No, I want to look into their face. I want to be with them when they cry. I want to wrestle with them. I want to talk with them. I want to reason with them. I want to spank them sometimes. I want a relationship, not a religion. I spent years with religion without relationship. He didn't come to die so we could have religion. He came so that we could have life, so that we could be forgiven, so we could know him and walk with him. If you want that today, we're not playing church, nothing phony. We'll have the musicians come. We're going to sing one last.